Lord Dalhousie instituted a policy whereby if any Indian king died without a natural son, he would take over that territory. And he called this the doctrine of lapse. Said this territory has lapsed.
Welcome to Fox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. British rule in India lasted a couple of centuries, but it was over almost 80 years ago now. Can we still detect its influence in India's economy today? Lakshmi Iyer of the University of Notre Dame is one of the authors of new research that examines that colonial legacy and the effectiveness of the policies designed to remove it. When I spoke to her, I first of all asked her to tell me a little bit more about the history of British rule in India. Lakshmi, we should start with some history, shouldn't we? For how long was India a British colony and when did it stop being one?
So it was about almost 200 years. So that's a pretty long time to be a colony. So usually people date the beginning of the British Empire in India to 1757, when the British East India Company won the Battle of Plassey and got control over the province of Bengal. Though the British East India Company had been in India for many decades before that, they arrived in the early 1600s for trade purposes. But 1757 is when they assumed administrative control of at least one part of India. Over time, the British Empire extended to cover most parts of present-day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And these three countries became independent in 1947.
And 1947, though, that's quite a long time ago. Why does economics suggest that we might still be seeing the effects of colonial rule today?
And that is an absolutely important question, Tim. So there are many reasons. First, there are direct channels of persistence. Many colonies retain the formal institutions and ways of working of the colonial powers. It is not a coincidence that India is a parliamentary democracy and not a different type of political system. It's because we were a British colony. Similarly, the legal system derives from English common law, just like in Britain. And that's, again, so there are explicit colonial legacies in terms of institutions. There can be other channels. So in many cases, colonial rule disrupted the way things worked in the former colonies and changed their economic structures, say by doing a lot of resource extraction, by introducing new technologies, which could be for the better or for the worse, right? There are many things the colonial powers did that could change the economic structure of these economies. One study in Africa finds that even the investments in infrastructure like roads and health centers and schools made by the colonial powers persists. And some of it is through changing the balance of power in the former colonies. So places that had, for instance, more schools during the French colonial period continued to get more education funding even in the post-colonial period. And so this is why some people have also discussed that this could set up self-reinforcing cycles. So colonial policies made a particular place impoverished. That place then has less political power or less political influence in the post-colonial period and therefore are not able to advocate for themselves to get these gaps rectified. So you can have many different reasons why colonial rule or any kind of historical incidents have long-running effects.
But in the post-colonial period, if some people or regions are disadvantaged, then everyone wants to fix that. Why does it take so long to fix?
I think that is the important question, which we try to address in this paper, is how long does it take? So on the one hand, you have presumably greater accountability and people's interests at heart in a post-colonial government than in a colonial government who is more responsible to the colonial power. And so you might expect that these gaps could get reversed. So there could be two reasons why they don't get erased, even over a long period of time. One is that, as I said, the structures of power itself might change. So certain groups get into power during the colonial period, they maintain their dominance. In the post-colonial period, they benefit certain types of areas only. So it's not the case that post-colonial governments are as accountable or as fair-minded as we might aspire to believe.
Right.
So there are imperfections in that place as well. And the second is, once, say, the way people make their living or economic structures are changed irrevocably, it may be actually very hard to get back. So Nathan Nunn has a wonderful paper, if you look back at the Journal of Development Economics in 2007, but he sets up this very simple theoretical model. And he says, well, if there are two possible equilibria, one with sort of more optimal economic activities, which rely on proper property rights protection and on stability, and the other is what people do when they are subject to a lot of uncertainty and rent extraction oppressive practices, which is they do not invest in long-term things. They do short-term activities, or they join in that kind of predatory activity. So he's motivated by the example of Africa, where a lot of Africans themselves engaged in the slave trade and enslaved their fellow Africans in order to sell them to European slave traders. So they switched their entire basis of economic activity to preying on fellow citizens rather than generating something together with them. And he says, once you get stuck in this suboptimal equilibrium, it can be self-reinforcing. It is hard to break out. You get used to doing only these type of activities. Just because the original impetus goes away, you can't always snap back. So it can take a very long time to break out of that.
Now, in this work, you tested two institutions to see whether this persistence, whether that is still a factor. Which two did you choose? Why did you choose them?
Reading the history of India, which shows two of the biggest things which are different across the different regions of India. So first, even though India was a British colony, it turns out that not all of India was under direct British colonial rule. Nearly a quarter of the population was actually ruled by Indian kings. Mm-hmm. So they were not ruled by British administrators. They were under the control of the British Raj, as it was called, because these kings were not allowed to have independent foreign policies or defense policies. So they could not maintain armies beyond a certain level, because obviously the British colonial powers were afraid of rebellions. But in internal matters, they had a considerable autonomy. They could have their own currencies, they could have their own laws, they could have their own education policies, and any other internal matters. So it's quite striking that it was a very large part of the country that had a different type of leader than a direct British colonial rule. So I think it's an interesting question. What kind of long-lasting effect does that history have? There were about 680 of these native states, or princely states, as the British called them. They could not call them kings because the only king they could acknowledge was the King of England. So they were only called princes, even though some of their territories were larger than Britain. And when India became independent in 1947, all of these princely states were incorporated or merged into independent India. So in terms of post-colonial institutions, policies, and so on, they have the same structure as the parts of India that were under direct British colonial rule. However, do they still have different paths in the post-colonial period? And this is what I was interested to investigate. So that was one big difference. The second big thing I was looking at was within British India, the biggest source of government revenue for both the East India Company and for the British Crown later was land tax, because India was predominantly an agricultural economy. And so collecting land tax was a major task, and the arrangements which the British made for collecting this land tax are of paramount importance. And when I was reading a lot of history, I found that the arrangements they made to collect the land tax varied a lot across different parts of the country. So in the eastern parts of the country, in the provinces of Bengal, in the modern state of Bihar, they had what was called the Zamindari system, which was the British just appointed or co-opted large landlords, and they said, okay, you are a large landlord here, you have this area, you're going to collect such and such an amount of land tax and give it to us. How you get it is not our concern. Right? So it was a more arm's length relationship with the actual cultivators that the British state had. While in other areas like Madras Presidency, Bombay Presidency, the British implemented what is called the Rayatwadi system, where they actually did detailed surveys of the agricultural land, provided property deeds to individual farmers, and they told individual farmers what their tax liability was. So again, they're collecting the same land tax, but in a different way, making different institutional and state arrangements to do it. In Punjab and some parts of the United Provinces, they had a slightly in-between system where village bodies were the contracting body. They were the ones responsible for collecting the land tax. And we had, when we were studying this, we were like, what do we classify them as? And they were an in-between category because some of those village bodies consisted of one person. And so we said, well, that looks like a de facto landlord, while other village bodies consisted of everybody in the village. So in some sense, it looks much more like an individual cultivator or Ayatwari system. So there was an in-between. We had to classify them in an in-between manner as well. And so one of the questions was, well, how does this matter? Right? This was the single biggest decision British administrators had to make in any territory they conquered. Again, when we come to post-colonial India, there was no land tax, right? So agricultural taxes were abolished, and the Indian state made a lot of effort to abolish the institution of landlords. So there were many pieces of legislation passed to abolish landlords, to provide tenants better rights, to redistribute land from large landlords to small landlords. And again, the question was, does that erase the colonial legacy?
So to test the legacy, the different legacies of direct and indirect rule, in this research, you chose access to schools and health and roads. Why did you pick those particular public goods?
For several reasons. One is that we believe health and education are important markers of human development in and of themselves, and can also be important drivers of future economic growth. And similarly, roads are very important for connecting to markets for trade. And so we thought these are important determinants. And the second was data availability. Ideally, we would have liked to have measures of economic growth like GDP growth or something like that. We couldn't find that at the very local level, at the district level, which we're looking at in India, which is below the state level. Mm-hmm. We couldn't find those measures. So these are kind of indirect proxies. And data for these was available from decennial censuses going as far back as 1961. We could get fairly consistent data over time. And that's obviously important to assess how things are evolving. So that's why we chose these things. We also chose, we also got not just how many schools and how many health centers are provided, but we also got measures of education attainment, of infant mortality as health and education outcomes. We got those from nationwide surveys, like the National Family Health Survey and the National Sample Survey. The National Sample Survey also gives us a measure of per capita household consumption, which we do use in this paper. It's not as precise because they don't, just for technical data reasons, they sample a group of districts together rather than district by district. So it's coarser data. So we do use some of that.
You originally did this using data, I think, that went up to 1991 when you first did this research. What did you find about the colonial legacy at that point?
So this was a paper I wrote many years ago. As you said, I looked at data until 1991, and I wanted to check whether these princely states or indirectly ruled areas look different than the directly ruled areas. One problem with just comparing indirectly ruled areas with directly ruled areas is, well, the British didn't choose directly ruled areas at random.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just toss a coin and said, I'm going to take over this area or not. In many cases, they had to fight battles and commit a lot of resources to actually obtain control over that area.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the map of India, it's very clear how they chose to conquer or which areas they chose to take over for direct rule. All the coastline, most of it, is directly ruled areas. The fertile northern valleys where we have lots of rivers like the Ganges River are also directly ruled areas. The central parts of the country which are heavily forested or the western parts of Rajasthan which are mostly desert are not part of directly ruled areas. British areas. And that makes sense. Those places did not have much agriculture. There was not much revenue to be extracted from there. So any comparison of these two areas runs the risk that are we really comparing direct versus indirect British rule, or are we comparing some natural features of these places, which also would shape how they evolve in the long term? And so for that, to overcome this, in the original paper, I used a historical accident, which was a somewhat strange policy by one of the East India Company's Governor Generals, Lord Dalhousie. Lord Dalhousie was Governor General from 1848 to 1856, relatively short span of time. Over this time, he considerably expanded the territories controlled by the East India Company, and he did that in many ways. He fought battles, pretty large battles, to conquer certain areas like the Punjab. But he also instituted a policy whereby if any Indian king died without a natural son, he would take over that territory. And he called this the doctrine of lapse. Said, this territory has lapsed. Right. That was the term used.
Right. So this means you can use, you have some randomization within this.
Exactly.
That you can use to uncover that effect. And so with that then, rather than just doing a straightforward comparison of the two areas, what do you find?
So when we do that, so we are basically comparing places that were unlucky enough to have your ruler die when Lord Dalhousie was around, and that to die without a son, then you got taken over. So we can use this as a somewhat random determinant of whether you became British or not. Using that, when we compare them in the post-colonial period in 1991, which is pretty late, we find that these areas, the directly ruled areas, actually look worse than the indirectly ruled areas. What do I mean by worse? They have fewer health centers, they have fewer schools, they have less roads, and consequently also worse educational outcomes, higher infant mortality, and things like that. So they look much worse, even as late as 1991.
Right. So as late as 1991, that's the case. Now, you have now updated this because you have some more recent data as well. What have you found from that?
Yes. So at the risk of revealing my age, I realized it's almost 20 years since the original paper. So I thought it's a good time to see what happened after collecting 20 years more of data. Mm-hmm. I was helped by my co-author on this paper. I want to give a shout out to Colson Weir, who is a PhD student at my department. And he was a fantastic person to work with. When we update the data, we look at 2001 and then 2011, we find that all the gaps we had documented before are gone. So to give a couple of examples, in 1991, we found that directly ruled areas had almost 9 percentage points less likely to have a middle school. There was a 20 percentage point gap in the probability of having a road. But by the time you come to 2011, the gaps are basically zero. They have the same likelihood of having a middle school, of having a road, of having a health center. So that's one. It's just there were large gaps before, which have disappeared. And the human development outcomes carry that pattern, right? So infant mortality used to be a little bit higher in the directly ruled areas, and the gap has become less. So if you look at the 1970s, they had 4 percentage points higher neonatal mortality, that is the probability of children dying in the first month of life. That has gone down to 1%. So that's, you see that convergence, so to speak, in the associated outcomes. So it's not just providing empty schools or empty health centers.
I mean, this is extremely interesting. I'm going to hold off from asking you why about this, because I want to ask you about the other half of the data as well for the land tenure research. What similar differences were you able to exploit to be able to do this research?
In the land tenure data, we focused primarily on agricultural outcomes because we said this is about land. We should see, you know, outcomes related to land first. And so we were tracking agricultural investments such as irrigation, fertilizers, using better seeds like the ones introduced by the Green Revolution. And then, of course, tracking agricultural yields, so output per hectare. in our earlier paper, so again, this was a paper I wrote with Abhijit Banerjee many years ago, we had data up until 1987, and we found that actually the landlord areas were significantly behind the non-landlord areas.
Right.
In terms of all of these outcomes, they had less irrigation, they had less fertilizer, they had less use of the petro seeds, they had, consequently, not surprisingly, they had much lower yields. They had 20% lower yields. And that's a lot. It's a huge difference. And it was very interesting, the things we found in that earlier paper were that, as I said, it was primarily attributable to the fact that these landlord-based areas were not adopting the new technologies in the 1960s, the Green Revolution technologies. We're not quite sure why. We found that these states, which had a lot of landlord areas, did spend a lot of time and effort doing land reforms, so abolishing landlords, redistributing land, and they also did much less of development spending, which includes, you know, social spending on health, education, and agricultural extension, agricultural technologies. So we feel that perhaps their political priorities were different in that initial post-colonial period, and they were busy undoing the colonial institutions of landlords and so on. And they sort of missed the bus on adopting new technology. And so I was very curious, well, did they catch the bus later on? Right? So
absolutely. If we extend the data, absolutely. By another 20 years. It's time to catch a later bus. Yeah.
Exactly. Did they catch a later bus? And so we updated the data using mostly the similar underlying data sources from the Government of India season crop reports and so on and so on. And all that is detailed in the paper. So what we find is a mixed picture. Some of the gaps we documented in the earlier paper, which is still 1987, have closed. So if you look at irrigation gaps, mm-hmm. right? So if you look at our original paper, we found that the landlord areas had 7%, they were 7% less likely to have irrigation. While if you look at the later period data, which goes up until 2011, the gap is zero, right? So the irrigation has caught up. If you look, on the other hand, on fertilizer use, the landlord areas had about 17 kilos per hectare more fertilizer use. And that actually, the gap widens, and they have now 27 kilos per hectare more fertilizer use. So that gap has not actually closed. If you look at the adoption of high-yielding varieties, that is, these better seeds or the Green Revolution seeds of rice and wheat, the gap has closed. But if you look at other cereals, it has not. So it's a very mixed picture in terms of agricultural investments. And I think because of this mixed picture, we find that the yield differentials are still there. They are smaller, but they are not completely gone. So for instance, we documented something like, as I said, 23% higher wheat yields in our earlier paper. In this paper, in the later period of the data, we find that wheat yields in the non-landlord areas are 17% higher, which is still a considerable gap. So it's a much more mixed picture as compared to the direct versus indirect rural gap. So it was interesting to find that some places, some of the historical legacies have been erased and others have not.
Lakshmi, we have a puzzle. Why is it yes. that 70 years on, some of those gaps have closed, good news, but some have not?
That is absolutely the great question, Tim. And this is where we are still in a more speculative stage. One is our current speculation is that it depends on the type of post-colonial policies adopted by the post-colonial state. So if you look at things like education and health, the Indian government adopted explicit policies of equalization. So they said there was a minimum needs program in the 1970s, which said where every village that does not have a school should get a school. So when you're thinking about investment in schooling, it is prioritized towards places that didn't have a school. Similarly, in the 2001, they implemented a Sarva Siksha Abhiyan, which is another education program where they said, well, everybody must get access to a good education until age 14. And so we will invest in places that do not yet have good educational outcomes. In fact, some states, I remember talking to the education minister of Kerala, he was very upset. He said, we have done very well. What we need is high school funding, and we're getting nothing from this program because it's targeted towards the lower levels of education. But that was an explicit policy to target places that were underachieving. In irrigation, similarly, there was the accelerated irrigation program in the late 1990s, which said, well, we're going to provide last mile connection to irrigation networks to places that don't yet have a connection. So there were many policies of this type. And you can see, now we cannot prove it that these were exactly the ones which contributed to closing the gap, but it is quite interesting that those are the gaps which we see closing quite convincingly in schools, in education, in irrigation. In terms of roads, there were mixed set of policies. There was road building program, the Pradhan Mantri Gram Sadak Yojana, which targeted unconnected places. So that would potentially explain why we see a narrowing of the gaps in roads. In terms of fertilizer, there wasn't this type of prioritization. There is a universal fertilizer subsidy. The Indian government subsidizes fertilizer purchases, but that's available to everybody. So it's not targeted only towards places that use less fertilizer. So in some sense, it may be not surprising that we don't see the fertilizer gap closing. So that's our current speculation. That is the type of post-colonial policy and how it's targeted. So the good news is that some of the gaps have closed. The not so good news is that when we look at gaps in per capita income, they are still there. They are smaller than before for the direct versus indirect rule, but they are not completely eliminated. So maybe it's going to take even more time for these investments in human capital and connectivity to bear fruit in terms of overall economic development.
Yeah, does this teach us something about the persistence of these post-colonial legacies in general and when they persist?
Yes, I think that's exactly. It teaches us that these things take a long time and you need targeted policies. So for instance, if there were more targeted income support policies, maybe we would have seen the income gaps also disappear. They have become smaller, but they're not completely eliminated. And I think also shows that changing the entire economic structure or types of economic activities of a given region is not feasible in a very short time frame. But it is possible. So I will focus on the glass half full part. It is possible to erase the legacies of the colonial past by post-colonial policies. So we don't have to give up and say, this is the past and it dooms us forever. No, I do not believe that.
Lakshmi, it's fascinating, as always, to talk to you about this. And thank you very much. Thank you very much for going back to your research. Thank you very much for talking about it today.
Yep. Thank you, Tim.
The paper is called The Colonial Legacy in India: How Persistent Are the Effects of Historical Institutions? The authors are Lakshmi Iyer and Colson Weir. It was published in the Journal of Development Economics 177 in 2025. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. where you will also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review.